So let's see. So we were in the middle of introducing techniques to decompose tensors that can be very complicated, with many, many different components, and try to break them down into some, ingredients that are much simpler than that. And we discussed that first at the level of the Newton, a Newtonian decomposition of a Newtonian tensor. So we talked about the velocity gradient in Newtonian physics, and we decomposed that into simple pieces: expansion, shear, and rotation. And what I want to do eventually, with today's lecture, is to do something similar in relativity. So we're going to start with the relativistic version of the velocity vector, so the space-time velocity u. And then we're going to construct a gradient of this if we're dealing with some kind of, situation where we have a velocity field defined in some open region in space. It will change from place to place. It's going to have a non-zero gradient. And we want to introduce a decomposition for that that's going to be analogous to what we did in the Newtonian situation. So I'm just building the steps to do this. And what we've done first in the last lecture is to think of the velocity field as given to us, as giving to us at each point in space-time a preferred direction of time. And in fact, a good way of thinking about this is you can think of yourself as an observer who chooses to follow the motion of a fluid element. And according to your, clock, according to your, measurement of spatial directions, that direction of time is your direction of time. So that's the time that you would measure on your clock if you move together with any one of those fluid elements. I'm thinking of a fluid here. What's, important here are not necessarily that, but, the fact that we're given a system of word lines that comes for free when we're talking about the velocity field. But the point is that the time direction defined by the velocity field would be the same time direction that you would measure if you were yourself moving together with that fluid element. So that introduces the notion of a commoving observer. And that commoving observer, moving with the fluid at every point where the fluid lives, means that while that preferred time direction that we introduce in space-time really has this operational meaning of being the time that would be measured by this observer. So the observer has a clock, measures time. The observer can set up rulers in the directions orthogonal to time, and those, define preferred spatial directions. So we have a preferred time. That's going to be the time as measured by that commoving observer. And we have a preferred notion of spatial directions. And, whenever we have this preferred vector field given to us, time-like vector field given to us in a given space-time, we can always rely on those notions. We do have, in a sense, a preferred notion of time given that vector field. So, space-time in general doesn't have a preferred notion of time. That's because, in normal settings or in typical situations, we may not have that vector field defined. But if it's defined, then we might as well use it in our way of breaking down space-time into time and space. And that's what the vector field allows us to do. So that's, I think I said more or less that last time, but I think it's an important aspect of this, and I think it gives us a means to, visualize what's going on here and try to see how the analogy with the Newtonian discussion of last week works. Because in the Newtonian discussion that we had before, all of our vectors only had spatial, components. And the idea here is that, well, when we do a decomposition of a space-time vector into a time and space component, well, the space component has a chance of having a Newtonian analog. And we're going to see what the Newtonian analog of the velocity gradient is in this space-time setting. So that's why I'm setting all of this. All right, so we start with that vector field, and we're thinking of the vector field as being tangent to a bunch of word lines. So those would be the word lines of the fluid elements. I'm going to parameterize the word lines with proper time. And that guarantees that the vector field is normalized in this way. So we've defined the acceleration vector as being the projection of the gradient of the vector field in the direction of the vector field. So that's what, you know, that's what would be zero if the word lines were geodesics, but in general they won't be geodesics, and the failure to be a geodesic is measured by a spacetime acceleration vector defined by this. And we worked out last time that this acceleration vector is guaranteed to be orthogonal to the velocity vector. So that comes from the definition. We introduced a projection operator that basically removes anything that's in the direction of u. So if we act on this on a vector, for example, we kill the component along u, and that picks out for us the spatial components. So it's a very useful thing if we're going to really go crazy with this decomposition of, you know, vectors and tensors into time and spatial components. That's going to be a key tool. And finally, the last thing we did, I think last time, was to introduce a decomposition of an arbitrary tensor, arbitrary vector in space-time that normally would have four independent components. And we break it down into a time component, namely a component along u that involves a single scalar quantity. And then what's left over is something that's going to be declared to be orthogonal to the velocity vector. And because of that condition over here, we get three independent components, and that's a breakdown of a four, an object with four components into simpler pieces, namely one time component and three spatial components. That's just a simple example. We're going to see that while those ideas can be applied to tensors, and then, you know, the breakdown is even more systematic in terms of simpler pieces. And the final thing is that once we introduce this decomposition with the stipulation here that the, you know, perpendicular version of the vector is orthogonal to u, then we can actually extract all the pieces individually. Namely, the time component is just the projection against u, whereas the spatial components are just the projections against p. So that's how we can, you know, do this. And if we can do it for a vector, well, we can adapt the ideas, do it for a tensor. So that's what I'm going to do next. But the ultimate goal is to do it for the velocity gradient. So the velocity gradient will be decomposed into all the smallest pieces that we can come up with. And then we'll do what we did in the Newtonian theory to think of the spatial, as, you know, the spatial part of the velocity gradient and decompose that into an expansion, a shear, and rotation tensors, you know, things that will have a direct analog to what we did in the Newtonian theory. And in fact would reduce to exactly those Newtonian things if we were considering non-relativistic situations. So basically that's the goal for at least the first part of this lecture, is to achieve what we achieved for the Newtonian things, but now do it in full relativity. Okay, so that's where we are, and the next thing I'm gonna do is to apply those ideas to a decomposition of a general tensor. So let's think of a decomposition of a tensor, two-index tensor to begin with, but that's all I'm going to need. Decomposition of a tensor instead of a vector. So I'm going to start with a general two-index tensor defined in space-time, whatever it is. And then what I want to do is to break it down into simpler pieces. Because, you know, this being a tensor, it has, you know, a potential of having 16 independent components. And that's a complicated object. And that's why we would like to break it down into smaller things. So the first thing we could do is to take a projection along u and identify the time-time component of that tensor. So that would be the first piece that we can identify, the one that comes purely with a time component if we're working in that co-moving frame. And then we're gonna have time-space, space-time, and then space-space components of that tensor. So the next, you know, the next part of the decomposition here is that it will have a time component, namely a piece along u, but then there's gonna be a spatial part to this that will be purely spatial in the sense that it's gonna be orthogonal to u. And that would be a time-space component to the tensor. And then we might have a space-time component to the tensor. And finally, we will have space-space components, namely, you know, pieces of the tensor that will be fully orthogonal to U. And this I'll call D alpha beta with two, you know, mentions of being perpendicular because it's twice perpendicular to U. So the conditions here that I'm introducing are that, well, this purely spatial vector over here, that's going to be orthogonal to U. So that's one condition on that vector that tells me that it's got three individual components. I'm going to have a very similar condition on C. So it's also going to be purely spatial and come with three individual components, three independent components. And then that guy over here, which is doubly orthogonal, well, that's, you know, that satisfies a larger number of conditions, namely that it has to be orthogonal to U in both indices. And because we have three conditions here, three conditions here, we start at 16, and 16 minus 3 minus 3, I think that gives us 10. So let's see if the count is okay. So here we have one component. Here we have three components. Here we have three components. And let's see, I'm up to, so here I need 9. If I'm going to add up to 16. So let's see, what's what did go wrong here? So I have three conditions. Yeah, there's something I'm not seeing, but I don't think we need to worry too much. Sorry, it's bugging me, but I don't think I'll find the... I don't think I'll find the missing one. Anyway, so that's the idea. So by incorporating this this decomposition here, we break something that might be very complicated, you know, lots of individual components into much, you know, smaller pieces. And that piece over here will be the time-time. That would be the time-space part of the tensor. That would be the space-time portion of the tensor. And this would be the space-space component. All right, so that's the idea. And what we would like to do is to, okay, so that's something we can always write down, but you know, what we would like to do is to figure out what all the pieces are. So we want to extract from the general tensor what all the individual pieces are. And then, you know, in an application of this, there would be interpretations that could be given to all of those pieces. And the way to do this is actually pretty simple. So the best way of doing this, I'll go over here. The best way of doing it is to take our original tensor, and what we're going to do is to act on that tensor twice with the metric. Sorry. Yeah, let me write it like this. So we're going to say that A alpha beta is going to be G alpha mu G beta nu. And we write this identity. And at some, you know, at this point, we're not, you know, objecting to anything because that's just an identity. But what I can do is to go one step beyond that and rewrite the metric in terms of u times u and the projection operator. So what I can do here is to say that this metric, you know, if I just solve for the metric, given the definition of the projection operator over there, I can say that this is minus u alpha u mu plus the projection operator. And then I have something similar here for the other factor of the metric. And all I have to do is to, just apply the multiplication. So when we multiply, we're going to get a whole bunch of terms. So let's just do it one by one. So we're going to multiply this times this times this. That's going to give us u alpha u beta. And then what's going to be left over here is u mu, u nu, a mu nu. And that obviously gives us the time-time component, and it identifies for us what A actually stands for. So we're going to read this off in a second. Then if we multiply this by this by this, we're going to get something involving u alpha. Comes with a minus sign, so let me put it inside the bracket. And what's going to be left over here is going to be minus u mu p beta nu a mu nu. And when we look at this, so we see the explicit factor of u alpha, so that's, you know, a good indication that it's going to build up to be this term over here. But more importantly than this, or at least equally important, we have a tensor over here that's guaranteed to be orthogonal to u beta because of the projection operator appearing right here. So that's going to be the definition for b beta perpendicular that is guaranteed to be orthogonal to u. All right, keep going like this. Then we're going to have, I'm going to put the minus sign over here. We're going to have p alpha mu u nu multiplying a mu nu. And what's going to be left over after this is going to be u beta. So that's, you know, that's our third term in the space-time part of the tensor. We get our explicit factor of u beta, and here we get a tensor that's necessarily orthogonal to u, so that's going to be our c alpha perpendicular. And then when we're all done, we're going to have this times this times that, and that's a tensor that's guaranteed to be twice perpendicular to the velocity vector. So just reading off what we have, is that A is, of course, the projected tensor along u twice. We have that B alpha perp, well, that stands for the second thing we find in the bracket there, except that, okay, I'm going to write it with an index beta to use the same notation. So that's minus u mu p beta nu acting on the tensor. And then we have C alpha perp. That's what we have in the third bracket. That's going to be minus P alpha mu U nu multiplying our general tensor. And finally, the doubly orthogonal piece, the purely spatial piece, well, that's going to be two projection operators orthogonal to U multiplying our tensor. So basically, that's how we can systematically decompose, in this case, a two-index tensor into the smallest pieces we can find, given that we're dealing here with, you know, one vector field that gives us a preferred time direction. And, you know, if you were to repeat this for a three-index tensor, four-index tensor, you could go crazy like that for any, you know, a tensor of any number of indices, the procedure would be exactly the same. The trick is always to start with a metric, decompose the metric, and after that, just, you know, do the multiplication. Here it was easy. There were a few number of terms. As the number of indices increases, of course, means that you have to multiply more things, but, you know, the strategy is always the same, and the procedure is very straightforward. So it's all, you know, very systematic and very, you know, straightforward, I think.
All right. Do you have a question?
Yes, please.
I think there is another condition on d alpha beta due to the trace of A. If you contract A alpha with beta, then we will obtain a condition for the trace of d alpha beta.
Yes, that's true. And I didn't want to incorporate any trace conditions. That will come a little bit later, but at this stage I didn't want to say anything about trace.
So I'm that reduced that 10 components into 9 components.
Yeah, but there's nothing that prevents this from having a trace, right? So I'm still not clear about where that missing condition is, but you know, I'll get back to you at some point when I figure it out, maybe this afternoon. Any questions about this? Yep.
So when you multiply the GG operator there,
yep,
with a symmetric tensor, it doesn't matter that the indices alpha, beta, and mu, nu are symmetrized.
Right.
But if I want to talk about the operator by itself and expand it as a product and look at individual operators, it becomes important that the indices are symmetrized.
So I didn't want to say that this tensor was symmetric, so I didn't assume that. If I were to assume this, then of course it would be obvious that the B vector would be the same as the C vector, because that would come from the symmetry property, and then this would be further symmetric. But you're right. So if we were dealing with, if we were dealing with this situation, then all the symmetries would work themselves out, and those equalities would be guaranteed. You could make it explicit, for example, if you know that this is a symmetric tensor, you could make this, even more explicit by symmetrizing the indices in front. It's not really necessary, but that's something you could do as maybe a safeguard or something, or extra precaution, and that would be fine. But you know, in the general context, where you don't have an assumed symmetry, then you just do it in the most straightforward way possible. Yeah. So, but that raises a good point, and the point is that if you have additional symmetries in the tensor, then of course the number of independent components would be smaller than this, and that would be reflected in the decomposition. For example, in the symmetric case, it would be reflected in the equality between B and C, and the symmetry of D itself. So the number of components can always be lower than claimed if you have symmetries at play in the original tensor. Other questions about what we've done so far? Okay, so that's the general idea, and we can apply the general idea to the gradient of the velocity vector. So this. I'm going to need that, so I'm going to stay here. So now I want to decompose that object. Presumably because, while I explain my, reasoning behind this, the reason why we would want to do this, because eventually we want to describe null hypersurfaces, we want to describe them in terms of the geodesics that are running on that surface, and we want to describe how the geodesics behave relative to others, and we're going to work this out through the gradient of the tangent vector. So here I'm doing something analogous in a time-like situation because, well, we're building up the expertise, and that gives us a simpler context. But in the context of its own thing, the velocity gradient is clearly something that's important. We saw what it is in the Newtonian context. We saw that it plays a role in fluid mechanics when we're describing, for example, viscous fluids. So that's something that can be equally important in relativity. So the importance of deriving a decomposition of this is the same as what we had in the Newtonian context. Okay, so basically I want to apply this decomposition to this tensor. It doesn't matter if the indices are down versus up, that doesn't change anything. All we have to do is to work out all the individual pieces by just making all of those projections and see what we get. So let's go through that exercise. And before I get into it, I just want to do a little side calculation. I've done this before, but I want to make sure that we're not surprised by this. So here's a little side calculation before we get started. So I want to prove that if I have something like this, where we have the velocity gradient, but it's multiplied by the velocity in this combination of indices where the u, the alpha here is contracted outside the gradient and inside the gradient. So if I had beta here, it would be something very different that would give me the acceleration vector. But here I'm contracting with u alpha, with a u alpha being differentiated. And I want to claim that this is zero, and that's, you know, something that we did before, but I just want to reiterate this. So I'm going to write it as half of itself plus half of itself. And the first version of itself I'm going to write down is going to be exactly the same as I started with. But then I'm going to write half of itself in a slightly different form, where I allow myself to lower the index here and raise it here. And we can always do that when we work in a connection that's compatible with the metric. We can freely throw in the metric in there, and that doesn't change anything. So that's just exactly the same as this. But if I write it like this, I'm sure you can see that we're dealing with the product rule. And what we're dealing with here is the gradient of u alpha times u alpha. So I'm basically just applying the product rule, where I leave this alone to get this, and then I leave this alone to get that. So it's literally exactly the same thing. And now I can use the fact that I'm dealing with a tangent vector field that's everywhere normalized. So everywhere where it's defined, it's equal to minus one. And of course, the gradient of a constant is always zero. So that little piece here, which we'll see over and over again, we can always kill because it's guaranteed to be zero. So that's something that I wanted to do once and for all, because we're going to be using this repeatedly in this calculation. Okay, so let's go back to the decomposition over here. And what I want to do is to identify all the ingredients of the decomposition. So we're going to be calculating all of those things. So my tensor now has a very specific identity. I want to apply the projections to that. So if I define A to be the projection of the A tensor on U twice, we're going to get U mu U nu times the gradient of U. And by the side calculations I just did, we see a nu, you know, u nu, u nu here. So this is automatically zero. So already we know that that tensor we're dealing with has a vanishing time-time component. So that's good. So that kills some of that stuff already. Then we have B beta perpendicular to U. And that's the projection along U and the projection along, I'll write it like this, along P. And we have grad U. And that's something that we can work out. So we see that U is being contracted with the gradient operation. So that combination here gives us the acceleration vector. So what we're dealing with here is the projection along P of the acceleration vector. And we know that the acceleration vector is already orthogonal to U, so presumably the projection here is redundant. And sure enough, if we, you know, write this in full, we see that that term disappears, and all that the projection does is to convert the index. So what we get here is minus the acceleration vector. So our B vector, in this case, orthogonal to U, is identified as minus the acceleration vector for that vector field. All right, so that's good. So, you know, we're proceeding along. So C, we can calculate exactly the same techniques. So it's going to be minus P alpha mu U nu times grad U. And again, we see that same contraction here, U outside, U inside the gradient, and that's guaranteed to be zero. So again, we kill something. And finally, we're down to the D thing, doubly orthogonal to U. And what we have to do now is to apply two projection operators onto the gradient. And to work this out, we're going to do what we did before. We're just going to re-express the projection operator in terms of the metric and the u vector and see what we get. So let me do it once. And then we'll do it again here. And again, same phenomenon. We kill one term over here and just use the metric to convert the index. So let's do that. And then we have grad mu. Sorry, that was mu. We have grad mu u beta. And let's see. So now we're going to get two terms. So we're going to get two contributions to that d tensor. So we're using the metric to convert the index. So the first thing is, oh, look at that. We're back to where we started. And then we get something more involving the acceleration vector and the velocity vector. So what do we get from all of this? We get that our original vector can be broken down into so A vanishes, so it's going to have a time-space component that we just worked out that happens to be minus U alpha A beta, plus a completely spatial part that happens to be, well, strangely enough, the original gradient plus U alpha A beta. So in the end, we end up with a very nice tautology, namely that the initial gradient is one piece plus the original thing minus that same piece. So it seems a little bit, you know, well, it seems a little bit pointless to have done all of this, but, you know, in fact, we've done something very useful because we know that this is going to be the time-space component of that tensor. We've eliminated the time-time component of the tensor. But more importantly, we know that this piece over here is purely spatial. So that's something that may not have been obvious from the start, but now we know from all the projection work that we did that this is purely spatial. So that is guaranteed to be orthogonal to U twice. So that's the time space component of the tensor, and this is the space-space component, purely spatial. And that's what the calculation teaches us. It teaches us that this is the thing that is most closely analogous to the velocity gradient in Newtonian physics, which itself was purely spatial. So when we talk about decomposing the full relativistic gradient of the velocity vector, that's the piece that's going to be analogous to the Newtonian velocity gradient that we dealt with last time. That has no Newtonian analog because, you know, there's no notion of vectors pointing in the direction of time in Newtonian physics, but this does. So that piece over here is analogous to the Newtonian velocity gradient that we've talked about before. And in fact, you know, if you were to look at this for relativistic fluid and looked at the components in the comoving frame and took, you know, a non-relativistic limit of that quantity, you know, when the velocities go small compared to the speed of light, you would find that, yes, this has only spatial components, but you would find, more importantly, that they all reduce to something simple like this in the proper Newtonian limit. So that's the thing that's analogous to what we did previously, the Newtonian version of the velocity gradient. This has no analogy. And because you know, this is still a complicated thing, that's the thing that now we're going to be decomposing even more into trace parts, shear parts, and rotation parts. So that's the next layer of decomposition beyond what we've just done here, which is decomposing, you know, along directions proportional to U, along U, or orthogonal to U. All right? So are we good at this stage? Yep.
Why we are not distinguishing the indices, the spatial indices and one-dimensional indices?
Oh, I could do that if I wanted to. So what I could do is to introduce a basis of vectors that would be orthogonal to U and pointing in the spatial directions. And I could do more decompositions along those new spatial directions. And then I could distinguish spatial indices from space-time indices. So that could be done. When we talk about hypersurfaces, I'll do that a lot. But at this stage, I think it's a layer that perhaps is not strictly necessary. So I decided not to do that. But yeah, it's a choice that's certainly available to us and might make things even more obviously corresponding to the Newtonian stuff. Other questions? Yep.
I'm a bit confused on how to physically interpret that the time component of this gradient that just.
Sorry, say again?
I'm confused how to interpret physically how the first component of A, the time component, vanishes. How do I understand that?
So how to give an interpretation to the fact that the A quantity vanishes, and therefore that the time-time component of the tensor vanishes? I don't know that I can give you an intuition behind this. It does come with the fact that we've parametrized all the word lines with proper time. If we had adopted a more general parametrization, if we didn't make the vector normalized, if we didn't have that u times u being equal to minus one, there would be a lot more stuff coming out in these equations. So I think the interpretation is a bit tricky because it's really specialized to that choice of normalization. But it's a good choice of normalization if we're dealing with time-like word lines, because it's always good to have the parameter synchronized with our clocks if we're moving along those word lines. But yeah, it would be nicer to be able to say physically that's why, here's an obvious way why it has to be this. I don't think I have that. And there's some deeper, mathematical reasons for that being zero instead of something else. Yeah. Okay, so let's look at that now. So we still have a fairly complicated object here, so it's purely spatial. So we killed all of the time-time and the space-time and the time-space aspects of the tensor, but it's still pretty complicated. So that's where we're going to go one step beyond and reintroduce the ideas that we used in a Newtonian sense. And now we're going to do the decomposition of a complicated matrix in terms of irreducible pieces the way that we did before. So let's introduce another layer of decomposition. And that's where we're going to have a decomposition in terms of trace, symmetric trace free. And anti-symmetric pieces. And the idea is, again, to boil it down to all the smallest bits that we can construct out of the complicated object. So that's where we rely on the analogy with the Newtonian situation, because now we know that being purely spatial, that's the tensor that has the closest analogy to the Newtonian velocity gradient. And if we introduce the same sort of decomposition, well, each quantity that we introduce in that decomposition will also be closely analogous to the Newtonian ones. And in fact, if you gave that a lot of thought, you would find that all of those quantities, if you, look at them in the comoving frame and you take a non-relativistic limit of that, you would find that all of those pieces that I'm about to introduce have exactly the same interpretation as in the Newtonian setting. I'm not going to demonstrate this, but at least we'll rely on the analogy. And the analogy is really taking the fact that we're dealing with a purely spatial tensor, as the most important aspect of this. Right. So what I want to do is to say, okay, so I'm still dealing with a fairly complicated object here. So it has, you know, this structure over here. So we know it's purely spatial, so that much is understood, but it's still very complicated. So we're going to break it down into, as I said, a trace part, a symmetric trace-free part, and an antisymmetric part. And the way to do this is going to be very similar to what we did in Newtonian physics. Maybe I should motivate some of the steps here a little bit. And I'll go back to this idea of the co-moving observer and thinking of that observer making using a coordinate system that's adapted to its motion and then breaking down everything in terms of space and time components. So if we're looking at this observer and we're thinking of using a coordinate system that's going to be adapted to the motion of that observer, well, in that coordinate system that moves with the observer, the velocity vector will have purely a time component. And as far as the observer is concerned, they're not moving in the spatial directions. You know, the reference frame is moving with them. So all the spatial components of the velocity vector are zero. So in that co-moving frame, we have a very simple structure for the velocity vector. And if we lower the indices and use the fact that at any point along the motion, we can set the metric to be Minkowski, that observer, lowered component of the velocity vector will be also very simple. Minus one along the time direction, and that's it. And if we work out the components of the projection operator in that coordinate system, well, it's going to be the metric minus u times u, which is minus one. It's the metric plus u times u, which is minus one, when it's not zero. So we're going to get basically a whole bunch of zero entries whenever time is featured. And for the rest of them, it's going to be something that looks perfectly diagonal in the spatial directions. So what I'm displaying here is the analogy with this and the Kronecker delta, or the metric that we would use in a Newtonian discussion. So what plays the role of the Newtonian metric in this relativistic space-time setting is the projection operator. So when I decompose my tensor in terms of trace, I'm going to use this as a replacement for this. So of course we have to adapt the idea. So the trace part that we're going to be introducing in our decomposition is going to feature the projection operator. So it has to generalize, of course, what we were doing in the Newtonian setting. In the Newtonian setting, we had the Kronecker delta, or the spatial metric of Newtonian physics. Here we could think, okay, let's replace this by the space-time metric. But that wouldn't do, because the space-time metric is not purely spatial. The space-time metric has a time-time component. And that's not allowed, because we know that this is purely spatial. So we have to kill that. And what's left over, of course, is going to be the projection operator. So what's going to dictate the structure of the trace part here is going to be the projection operator. And the coefficient in front, I'm putting a third, that's a convention. And that's going to be our good old expansion parameter, again, in direct analogy with what we had in the Newtonian setting. And then beyond that, we have the symmetric trace-free part that we're going to call sigma, and we're going to interpret this as the rate of shear deformation. And then we have the antisymmetric part that's going to be interpreted as the rate of rotation. So exactly the same interpretations in direct analogy to what we had in the Newtonian setting. So that's the decomposition. It comes with conditions. So sigma alpha beta is guaranteed to be traceless. So that means that its contraction with the projection operator has to vanish. And it's also symmetric. So it's defined to be symmetric and traceless. traceless meaning this, and then the omega tensor is defined to be anti-symmetric. And that makes all those conditions make the decompositions unique. And something we already know is that, well, this is doubly orthogonal to you, and all of those things here will be doubly orthogonal to you as well. So we have that sigma alpha beta contracted with u is zero, and we also have that omega alpha beta contracted with u is zero. That was guaranteed from the start because, you know, all of this is true for the left-hand side. So that's the further layer of decomposition we're introducing in analogy to what we did in the Newtonian setting. And then, as usual, what we would like to do is to, you know, find a way to extract all the pieces from this and be able to, you know, calculate separately theta and sigma and omega. So I'll just give the interpretations here. That's going to be the rate of expansion of the, you know, congruence of word lines that we're talking about here. That's going to be the rate of shear. And that's going to be the rate of rotation. And then I'm going to do a count of components in just a moment when we're, you know, when we're finished with this. Okay, so just to finish off the job here, what I'm going to do is to extract all the individual pieces from the thing on the left-hand side. Okay, so all of this over here is symmetric, defined to be symmetric. So I can get to the full thing here by just symmetrizing the indices on the left. And then what's going to be left over is omega. That's going to be defined by taking an anti-symmetric combination of all the stuff on the left. So if I symmetrize the indices on the left, I'm going to have the symmetrized velocity gradient plus the symmetrized combination of U and A. So symmetrization just means evaluate the tensor like this and then switch the indices, evaluate it again, take the average of the two. And what that gives us then is going to be the symmetrized combination of the right-hand side. The projection operator is symmetric. We don't have to do anything here. The shear tensor is symmetric. We don't have to do anything there. And omega is anti-symmetric, so it's symmetric, you know, combination, its symmetric part will vanish. So that's all that that we're getting. I still have those two things combined. I want to isolate them separately. So what I'm going to do first is to take the trace of this, taking the trace in the sense of multiplying against the projection operator. So if we do that, we're going to get 1/3 theta multiplying p alpha beta, p alpha beta. And we get nothing more because sigma is defined to be traceless. So that condition we wrote down before means that it drops out of this calculation. And this happens to be 3. And we kill the 1/3. That's why the 1/3 was there in the first place, to be sure that in the end we would kill it, so that theta is identified as all this stuff over here on the left-hand side. Now, it turns out we can simplify this. We can simplify the left-hand side, and we're going to see that it gives us something very simple. On the left-hand side, if I work this out, well, the first thing I can notice is that after multiplication by p alpha beta, which is symmetric, the symmetrization operation here becomes redundant, because it's always going to be true that if I multiply a symmetric tensor times anything anti-symmetric, that's going to drop out. So the symmetrization here becomes unnecessary after I've multiplied by P. It was necessary before, but at this stage, it's no longer necessary. So what we have here is simply the metric plus U alpha U beta multiplying grad U plus U, that was supposed to be A. So we have that. So we can multiply all the stuff. When we multiply all the stuff, okay, so here we get G, we get grad U, so we get the divergence of U. And then when we multiply the metric by this, we're taking the scalar product between U and A, and that's zero. When we multiply by here, we get U beta outside the gradient, U beta inside the gradient. So the side calculation tells me that this is zero all over again. And finally, we have U scalar with A, that's zero, all, you know, again. So that's the only thing that survives. Theta, in the end, ends up being the four-dimensional divergence of our velocity vector. In a Newtonian setting, it was the three-dimensional divergence. Here we have the direct analog to this. So the first piece is something that clearly will have a great deal of importance in the description of our word lines, and it's going to describe how it, you know, it all expands. So, and that's going to be measured by the divergence, four-dimensional divergence of the vector field. Okay, so that's our first piece. To get sigma, well, all we have to do is to go back to that expression and just solve for sigma, because now we know what theta is. So once we have this, we know that sigma is going to be the symmetrized quantity that we had on the left-hand side minus now the trace piece, which is fully identified. So we get this. Once we have, you know, once we have identified theta, we have everything we need to identify sigma alpha beta, so we can calculate straightforwardly from the velocity gradient. And finally, if we want to identify omega, all we have to do is to take an antisymmetric combination of the left-hand side. That's going to kill all the symmetric stuff. And we're going to be left with omega. So omega alpha beta is the antisymmetric combination of what we had in the left-hand side. So that's how we can measure all the individual pieces. And now that we have that and we combine everything, we're going to have the full decomposition of our velocity gradient with interpretations that can be, you know, attached to each piece separately. So when we do all of this, we end up with the final decomposition. We find that the full velocity gradient is going to be, well, first of all, the piece that we had over here, the time-space piece. And then the rest of it, and the rest of it has been, you know, decomposed according to what we had over here. So it's going to be the trace piece. It's going to be the symmetric trace-free piece. And finally, it's going to be the antisymmetric piece. So that's the final decomposition. And now we have it in terms of, you know, the smallest conceivable pieces. And we have, you know, an interpretation for each of those things here that matches up with the Newtonian interpretation. Because, again, if we work in the co-moving frame, what we're going to be dealing with here is something that's going to be a relativistic generalization to what we were describing before in the Newtonian context. And if it's appropriate to take a non-relativistic limit of that, we're going to end up with exactly the same interpretation for all of those things. So theta will be indeed the rate of expansion. Sigma will be the rate of shear deformation. Omega will be the rate of rotation. All of those interpretations that, you know, I took the time to introduce at the Newtonian level, well, are there also in the full relativistic context, with a little bit of, you know, caveats and and the fact that we're dealing here with, you know, velocity flows that are not Newtonian, they can be very relativistic. The fluid elements could move, you know, at speeds that are close to the speed of light. So it's going to look non-Newtonian, but still it has the same sort of interpretation. All right. And if we do a full count, we have one quantity here. The shear tensor being purely spatial and being purely being traceless means that there's five individual components, the same that we had in the Newtonian count. And this thing here has three individual components, just as we had in the Newtonian count. And then the acceleration vector has three individual components because it's orthogonal to the velocity vector. So in the end, we have a breakdown like this. And if we do the total count, we have 3 plus 1, that's 4, plus 5, that's 9, plus 3, that's 12. So that means that this tensor over here has 12 individual components. And that was always the idea. That's complicated because it's got lots of stuff in it. And by working it out like this, we can break it down into much smaller pieces that come with, you know, much clearer interpretations. And one good thing to remember is that this theta quantity here that I'm calling the rate of divergence, that's actually the space-time divergence of the velocity field. So that's probably the quantity that's the most important to us because it's going to tell us that the word lines are spreading out or converging. And that's something we can determine right away by, if we know the velocity field, we can calculate its divergence. And we already have some very important characterization of the flow by just computing theta. And then if we want more details, we can calculate the additional things as well. Okay, so let's see how we're doing on time. Got about half an hour left. Any questions at this stage? I don't know how to drink. Okay, good. So, okay, all of this was very formal, so I think a lot of this will become easier to understand if we work through some examples. So I'll work through a succession of examples here, and we're going to see how the interpretation is matched by what we actually find in those computations. So let's do that. So let me kill some stuff. Okay, so let's do an example. Okay. Okay, so I think the simplest example we can come up with in this context is what happens in a cosmological spacetime. So we're going to look at a Friedmann, Robertson, Walker, Lemaître cosmology. And I'm going to look at a special case of this, where the spatial sections of our universe are going to be flat. So I could do something more general, but it wouldn't really add any value to the discussion. So the important aspect here is that we have a spatial metric that is flat, but growing in scale over time. So that defines a cosmology for us, that defines an expanding universe. And the way to picture this is that, well, we have one spatial slice at, say, t equals 1, that's nice and spatially flat. We have another one at, you know, some later time, t equals 2. And all the scales have grown by some factor that's measured by a. So if we picture a galaxy over here, another galaxy over here, So the word line of the galaxies are going to be nice and co-moving word lines in that metric. So they're going to have x equal constant, y equal constant, z equal constant, but the distance will scale with a. So if a increases with time, then all the distances increase in proportion. So the word lines of galaxies are such that x equals a constant, and that's going to be same for y, that's going to be same for z. So I'm pretty sure that you've studied cosmological spacetimes before, so I'm sure that none of this comes as a surprise, but, you know, just to set the stage. Okay. So what I'm interested in here is the cosmological flow. So all of those word lines that represent word lines of galaxies, assuming that they're not, you know, having any proper motion, that would just add a little bit of complexity to this. So we're just looking at the cosmological flow and the velocity vector we're talking about here is simply going to be the one that stays, that follows those spatial, you know, word lines with constant coordinates, so that it only moves in the time coordinate. So the velocity vector is aligned with the time direction, and we can express it like this, or we can express it like this by lowering the index. And one property of this metric is that the GTT component of the metric is minus 1. So T measures proper time along those cosmological word lines. And then, you know, we can calculate the full velocity gradient of this. It's such a simple vector field that we can calculate the velocity gradient. I'll even do it by hand. In, you know, later examples, it's going to be a bit more complicated, so I won't do it by hand. And in fact, I'll advise you to find a way to calculate it by computer. That's going to be part of your self-education. To find ways to calculate these things on a computer and verify the results that I'm going to be telling you. Anyway, we'll get there in a minute. So let's calculate the velocity gradient for this. And we're going to see that the decomposition is going to be completely obvious. There's only going to be a trace term in this velocity gradient. And that just means that the only thing that happens in the flow is that it scales with a, so that all the distances scale with that factor. Okay, so let's do a calculation. So I want to calculate the full velocity gradient, and I'm going to do it in one sweep without thinking of decomposing it first, because in the end it's going to be so simple. And I'm going to do it as we always have to calculate it. We're going to expand the covariant derivatives in terms of partial derivatives and Christoffel symbols. So like that. And I'm going to simplify this right away because all the components of my velocity vector are constant. So the partial derivatives are going to be zero. So we only have a Christoffel term. And that simplifies also because there's only a time component to that velocity vector, which is equal to minus 1. So in the end, we only get Christoffel symbols with a T on top. So let's calculate those using the general formula for Christoffel symbol. So we have the metric with the appropriate component on top, the inverse metric. And then we have partial g mu beta, partial beta g mu alpha minus partial mu g alpha beta. So that's the general formula where I just fixed that index to match that index over here. We can use the fact that the only component of the inverse metric that has a t in it is going to be gtt, and that's going to be the same minus one as we had before, because the inverse of minus one is still minus one. So the only non-zero term in that sum over the repeated index mu is going to be t. So we can incorporate the fact that gtt is minus one, and that tells us that we get minus a half. And now we have partial alpha gt beta, partial beta gt alpha, minus partial t g alpha beta. Well, that simplifies a lot too, because, again, the only component of the metric that has a t in it is tt, and that's a constant. So whenever we take derivatives of that, we'll get zero. So in the end, the only thing that survives is the one half, the minus signs cancel, and all we have to do is to take a time derivative of the metric. And the only thing that comes with a time, with a time dependence is the scale factor A, and that comes for the spatial metric only, spatial part of the metric only. So if I just do a very simple calculation, I have to differentiate A squared with respect to T, that gives me 2 times A dot. The 2 kills the minus half, so what do we get? We get a times a dot. That multiplies a whole bunch of zeros if we're talking about anything with a t, but it's going to be diagonal in the spatial directions with a bunch of ones. So that's the structure of the Christoffel symbols, and that happens to be the same thing as, the velocity gradient. So very simple calculation in this case. We can compare that to the structure of the projection operator. Projection operator is metric plus u times u. And if we work this out, then, the tt component of this is going to be minus 1 plus 1, because this is going to be minus 1 minus 1. That gives us a 1, kills the minus 1, 0. Anything with time and spatial indices here will be zero. So a whole bunch of zeros over here, whole bunch of zeros over here. And then along the spatial directions, well, this will be orthogonal, and this will be diagonal, this will be zero. So over here, we just pick up the metric. And maybe I can be more clear and factorize the A squared, and then we get exactly the same matrix we had previously, which means that apart from those factors, we have an equality between the velocity gradient and the projection operator. And then, fixing all the factors, what we get from this calculation is that the full velocity gradient here is going to be a dot divided by a squared. So a dot over a times the projection operator. And that tells us that the full velocity gradient, in fact, is a pure trace term. It's fully proportional to p alpha beta. There's nothing symmetric and trace free. So no shear, there's nothing antisymmetric, so no rotation. So we get something which is entirely trace, which means that we can read this off as minus a third theta, which means that theta is 3 times a dot over a. And that comes with a ton of physical interpretation that I'm going to spell out in a moment after I answered questions about this calculation, if any. All good? Okay, so that goes to show that sometimes it's possible to do a calculation by hand, and sometimes it's even faster than it would be on a computer, because it probably would take me more time to set it up on the computer than to just do the calculation like this. So you have to, you know, identify what is best depending on the nature of the calculation, but this was really very simple. All right. What do we call A dot over A in cosmology? That's the Hubble parameter. It's the version of the Hubble parameter that actually evolves with the universe, as opposed to being evaluated at the present day. For that one, we call it H naught, and that becomes the Hubble constant. But that's the one that keeps on evolving as the universe evolves. A dot over A measures the fractional rate of growth of the universe. When we multiply by 3, we get the rate of expansion measured in terms of volume. So that's where the interpretation comes in. So theta is 3 times A dot over A. And I'm just going to write it in a slightly different form. I'll reinterpret this as 1 over A cubed ddt of A cubed. I think you can do that step. And that's where the factor of 3 comes from, because after I differentiate, I will get that factor of 3, and then the factors of A will sort themselves out. But the reason for writing it this way is because, well, what I could do is to take one of my spatial slices in my expanding universe, and I could pick a region, and I could see what happens to that region of space as the universe expands. So I'm going to bound this region over here. It's going to be a co-moving region, so it's going to grow with the universe as the rest of the universe expands. So if I have a region V here that's co-moving, then all the distances within that region will scale with A, and the volume will therefore scale with A cubed. So what I've calculated here is the fractional rate of change of volume for any co-moving region that I care to define. And I think that really drives home the interpretation of theta as a fractional rate of, you know, volume change, exactly the same interpretation as in the Newtonian context, but now it applies in full, you know, four-dimensional space-time cosmology, but it means exactly the same thing. So that's why we're calling this the rate of expansion, or, you know, the fractional rate of volume change, exactly as in the Newtonian setting. So the divergence of the vector field, or the, you know, the expansion scalar, is really the thing that measures how the flow of, you know, integral curves to that vector field U, you know, diverge from one another. So if we have a, you know, growing universe, of course they're going to be diverging. If we have a collapsing universe, they're going to be converging. The rate by which it does that in terms of fractional rate of change is measured by that quantity theta. And because of that, because of this interpretation, because it tells us something very, very, immediate about the flow of word lines, that's a quantity of you know, utmost importance. The shear will tell us how the little regions that you can define like this, how they will get deformed in time. The rotation will tell us how they rotate in time. That's also important, but I think in terms of overall interpretation and characterization of the flow, whether it diverges or converges is really, you know, probably the most important factor. And that's captured by theta. And fortunately for us, theta happens to be the easiest thing to compute. You have a vector field, calculate the divergence of that vector field in a mathematical sense, and you're done. So it's an immediately accessible quantity that tells us a lot. All right. So I think this example, is very revealing in this way. It's very simple. It's perhaps a little bit too simple, because all we get is, you know, an overall scaling of the flow. So we don't get any of those deformations that might be, you know, described by either the shear tensor or the rotation tensor. So for that, we have to do something a bit more complicated. And I'm going to do that in the second example. The price to pay is that, well, I'm not going to calculate the Christoffel symbols for that example because that would take too much time and I would get it wrong. So that's where the computer algebra becomes very handy. And that's where I'll tell you, those are the answers. Go and calculate them and learn how to do this with computer algebra, because you're going to thank me later. That's an invaluable tool. If you're going to do anything in general relativity, you need to be able to do that with computer algebra. Okay, so I've got maybe 5 minutes left for the lecture. So let me set up the second example, and then we'll complete it in the afternoon. All right, so now we're going to be working around a Schwarzschild black hole. So that's going to be time-like curves in Schwarzschild. So the metric is going to be the good old Schwarzschild metric. So f is the usual metric function, 1 minus 2 m over r. Here I could be thinking of the spacetime of a black hole, or I could be thinking of the spacetime outside a spherical star, so long as we're dealing with the vacuum region. Regardless, it's a vacuum solution to the Einstein field equations in spherical symmetry, and also assuming a static spacetime. So we set up this metric over here. And what I want to do is to set up a flow in that metric. And let me write down the vector field first, and then I'll tell you what it means in a moment. So here's a vector field that I'm introducing everywhere at least in an open region of the spacetime. So here, if I want to calculate the velocity gradient, it's pretty important that the vector field be defined in an open region so that I can differentiate in any direction. A temptation with dealing with Schwarzschild is that, well, we know we have spherical symmetry and we know that motion will take place, or at least geodesic motion will take place in a plane, and we could therefore restrict our geodesics or our flow to be in the equatorial plane. And that wouldn't work for the purposes here because, if I define the flow in the equatorial plane only, I can't take derivatives away from the plane. The vector field would not be defined except in the equatorial plane. So what I'm doing here, first of all, is not assuming geodesic motion. It's not going to be geodesic motion in general. And I want a vector field that's defined everywhere, not just in the plane. So that's one little motivation for the nature of the flow that I'm introducing here. But I'm going to introduce a velocity field. That's an overall normalization factor. I'm calling it gamma because it's basically the gamma factor of special relativity, but adapted in GR. It's going to have, apart from the factor gamma, it's going to have a component along the time direction. But then I'm going to say that the word lines that I'm talking about here are not going to be moving in the radial direction. They will be moving with a constant coordinate velocity in the theta direction, and they're not going to be moving in the phi direction. So here I'm ordering the components here in the canonical order, tr theta phi, and I'm just saying that it moves along t, it moves along theta, but the word lines actually don't move in r and phi, so they move with constant values of r and phi. So basically, I'm describing word lines that go around like this. I'll picture it in a moment because I don't think that's terribly mean. It doesn't mean much to you. It shouldn't mean much to me. Gamma is a normalization factor because I need the velocity field to be normalized. So if you plug that with the metric, you're going to find that gamma is 1 minus 2m over r minus omega squared r squared, to the power minus a half. And that ensures that the velocity field is properly normalized. For this to work, it's very important that what I'm putting inside the square root here be larger than zero. And the way that this is usually interpreted here is that this provides a bound for omega or omega squared. So given r, omega squared is going to be restricted to be smaller or bigger than something that depends on r. The other thing I should have mentioned is that omega is going to be assumed to be a constant. So it's going to be a constant coordinate velocity in the theta direction. So I'm basically describing circular orbits moving with constant r, moving in the angular theta direction, but not assuming necessarily that they're geodesic. So I want to preserve the liberty of not dealing with geodesics. And that has to do with the fact that I want my vector field to be defined everywhere. So just to finish off, I'll just draw you a picture. So if I pick, any sphere r equal constant in my space-time, then I'm describing word lines that move purely in the theta direction and, of course, in the time direction. But if I describe it in a purely spatial sense like this, well, it's basically going to start at the North Pole, it's going to move down in theta, and it's going to move to the South Pole, and then it's going to return. And so we're going to have a whole bunch of word lines like this that all move down from the North Pole down to the South Pole with, a motion along theta, keeping r fixed and keeping theta fixed. So it never moves in the azimuthal direction. It just moves purely in the theta direction. So that's that's one way we can represent the flow here. It's basically circular orbits but not geodesic orbits. The reason why I don't want the flow to be geodesic is because if we restricted the flow to be geodesic, that sphere would have to have a very specific radius of 3m. And then we would be down to having a vector field that's defined only on one sphere, and that would remove the ability to differentiate in all possible directions. So that's why I didn't want that. Right? And another thing that I'll mention before we return to this in the afternoon and go through the calculation is that, well, I think it's pretty clear that I have a singularity of the flow here and here. If you work out the tangent component of the velocity vector here, it points in, it's multivalued over here. So the velocity vector points in all possible directions at the North Pole and all possible directions at the South Pole. So that's a bit of a bad thing, but that's okay. I mean, we can put it in and see what the consequences are going to be. But it's going to be pretty clear, I think, when we start calculating things that, for example, the expansion of the flow here is going to be singular here because all the word lines are emanating from one point and diverging in all possible directions. So this is a place where we could expect, and we will find, that theta is diverging, and same thing here. All the geodesics are, all the word lines are converging to the South Pole, and that means that, well, the flow becomes singular, and that will translate into a singularity of all the quantities we're going to be calculating. And this is a situation where we're going to have a non-zero value for theta, non-zero value for the shear tensor, non-zero value for the rotation tensor. So all the features of the velocity gradient are going to be, featured in this example. Still a very simple example, but it's got enough in it that we can, see all of that stuff coming out. Okay, so let's leave it at that for now, and we'll pick this up again in the afternoon.
Can I have a question?
Yes, please.
The fact that theta, sigma, and omega is zero or non-zero, it is coordinate dependent?
No, so those things are tensors. So if it's zero in one coordinate system, it's guaranteed to be zero in all coordinate systems. So those zero statements are invariant. The actual expression, of course, will be, will be depending on the coordinate system in which you express them. But if it's zero in one coordinate system, it's guaranteed to be zero in all coordinate systems.
in flat spacetime, for instance, if we go to a rotational coordinate system, again, we obtain omega to be zero?
Yes, because omega doesn't measure the overall rotation that's shared by everybody. You would have that in a rotating coordinate system. What omega measures is the relative rotation that one word line sees relative to another word line. And that you cannot kill by a coordinate transformation.